Turn to Deuteronomy chapter 4. And verse 6. Deuteronomy chapter 4 and verse 6. We may not be able to escape the devastation, destruction of natural forces like hurricanes and rain and rising water, but we are equipped to face the threats of the storms of life as they wage war upon our family. Sometimes we don't know what to do in the face of storms, whether to stay or to run, what kind of defenses to make. But when the storms wage against our families, this verse tells us that there is a source that we can go to for instruction and wisdom. Moses was preaching to the children of Israel as they were about to enter the promised land. They had been surrounded, as you know, by idolatry for the past 200 to 400 years. And because of their surroundings, obviously had been immersed in those philosophies. I don't know what the family philosophies of the Egyptians were, but pagans, their philosophies about the family are certainly not anything that you would want to participate in. And so as they're going into the land, Moses is preaching this sermon, not only affecting their families, but their morality and their relationship to God, but it would certainly impact their families as well. Look at verse 6. He said, "So keep and do them." And what he's talking about, as you go back to verse 1, are the statutes and the judgments which I'm teaching you to perform. Verse 2, the commandments of the Lord your God. So he said in verse 6, "So keep and do them, for that is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the peoples, who will hear all these statutes and say, 'Surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people.'" If you could find people that knew enough about storms and storm preparation to where it doesn't make any difference what the storm was or how high the water got, they would be safe. See, I'd like to know what those people do. God says, "I'm going to give you some wisdom that will help you in any storm you may face, help you direct your step through life." And so that's what we're going to be doing in this quarter, looking to God's wisdom, God's Word, to help us build a family that will survive the wicked society that we're in and the assaults that are made upon it. We have young people in our class, and we're glad to have them in our class. One of your richest blessings is if you have a stable family. And so this study can be beneficial to you, because you can contribute to that or you can be a hindrance to that, as well as prepare you for the future when the time comes that you get married and start your own family. So I want to encourage the young people to be involved in our class. I'll likely be calling on some as the class progresses. I've only had the privilege to teach this group of young people one time, I think, in the past few years, but it was a real pleasure. And so we're glad they're with us today. Good, sharp group of young people, and we're glad they're in our class today. Genesis chapter 18. Genesis chapter 18. How many here are saying, "God bless America"? Nearly everybody, right? Do you want God to bless America? I sure do. Because it's with God's blessings that America will stand, and without God's blessings, America will fall. What can we do to make America strong? I know we hear the political statements about strengthening our army and taking care of our financial debt and all of that, and that's fine and good. But here's a story that's so valuable relative to how God deals with nations. And it was a lesson being taught to the patriarch Abraham. Look in Genesis chapter 18, verse 16. The Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do? Since. And as we read, we want to pay attention to those connecting words. Here's why God is going to tell Abraham about what he's going to do. Since Abraham will surely become a great and mighty nation, and in him all the nations of the earth will be blessed. For I have chosen him, so that he may command his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice, so that the Lord may bring upon Abraham what he had spoken about him. Now, what did he have just spoken about him? Make him a great nation. Is it conditional? It is, isn't it? You ever think of the Abrahamic promise as conditional? But he said, now, I'm going to show Abraham something that will be an impression on his mind as it impacts the promise I've made to him to make of him a great nation. So then he said, verse 20, the Lord said, the outcry of Sodom and Gomorrah is indeed great, and their sin is exceedingly grave. I will go down and see if they have done entirely according to its outcry, which has come to me, and if not, I will know. So then you have this conversation that all of you have read between Abraham and the Lord. And you remember how the conversation went. You remember that Sodom and Gomorrah was the residence of Lot, his nephew, and their family. And God was going to destroy the cities because of why? Gross immorality, right? No regard for God or will or moral standards. And so here we live in America. The moral standards of America continue to drop. And so how long will it be before God says, I've had enough, I'm going to destroy the United States of America or let some nation destroy it? I don't know that. But here's Sodom and Gomorrah. And so then you have this conversation that God gets in with Abraham. And so Abraham came near and said, verse 23, will you indeed sweep away the righteous with the wicked? Suppose there are 50 righteous in the city. Will you indeed sweep it away and not spare the place for the sake of the 50 righteous who are in it? Far be from you to do such a thing, to slay the righteous and the wicked, that the righteous and the wicked are treated alike. Far be it from you. Remember, this is Abraham talking, not God. But nevertheless, that's his plea. Shall not the judge of the earth deal justly? God, in his grace, without maybe correcting all of Abraham's views, said, if I find 50 righteous within the city, I'll spare the whole place on their account. I don't know what the size of Sodom and Gomorrah were. When we read about these cities, we think of it just a city. But they were actually city-states, independent governments. I don't know if there were 10,000, 100,000. I don't know. But let's take a small number, 10,000. If God would spare 10,000 for 50, that'd be pretty amazing, wouldn't it? But Abraham continues to plead with God. And so you notice he says in verse 28, what about 45? God said, okay, I'll spare it for 45. Then you go down to 40, verse 29. Then verse 30, you go down to 30. And then verse 31, he gets down to 20. And then verse 32, if I could just find 10. And what did God say? I'll spare the city for 10. Think about that, folks. You can't fly an airplane. You can't shoot a missile. You don't have the resources to fund the government. But you can live a righteous life. And God knows where you live. He knows about your family. Now, the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah, what was it? The notable sin?
Homosexuality.
That's corruption of God's plan for the family, isn't it? So here is a case where the family became so corrupted, led to this gross immorality, God's going to wipe the place away. What if he looks down and can see 10 people who say, I'm not practicing homosexuality or lesbianism. I'm going to honor God's will for my family. I'm going to try to live according to the will of God. Spare the whole place. That's what he said. I believe it, don't you? You and you and you and you can impact the destiny of the United States of America. That's amazing, isn't it? And that's the lesson there. What is? Some of you can quote Proverbs 14:34. What principle does it teach? Righteousness exalts a nation. Sin is a reproach to any people. And that's the way God's dealt with nations throughout time. The Amorites, God gave them over 500 years and finally said, enough is enough. He wiped them out of the land. Israel, time and time again, he spared them, but finally he brought their judgment upon them. And just true with nation after nation after nation. Righteousness exalts a nation, not its navy, not its army, not its money in the bank. It's righteousness that exalts a nation if we believe God is God of gods and Lord of lords. And so, tremendous reason for us to be concerned about the family if we love the United States of America. Any other comments on that before I move on? This is going to sound strange to you. Because of the limited time we have, just a quarter is all we've got on the family. There'll be a lot that we will not be able to cover. But when the class is over, I'll make some teacher notes available on the website. If you wish to study further, they'll be available to you. Look at Titus chapter 1. Titus chapter 1. How important is it when you travel that you can find a good group of saints worshiping together according to the will of God? Isn't that important to you? Or if you decide to move, or you get a job transfer, wouldn't you like to find a good group of people who are worshiping together? Not just a church, but a group of people who understand what a church of Christ is supposed to be. Where they've got some good leaders, spiritual leaders, men with knowledge and dedication. We look for that. We need that. Titus 1, Titus is a preacher on the island of Crete. And he's preaching in the various churches there on the island of Crete. You look at verse 5, there's some things these churches need. What is it?
Elders.
They need leadership. In verse 5, he said that he would set in order what remains. You heard me say, what's wanting? So these churches need something. They've got people. I don't know where they met as far as location. They've got people, but they need leadership, spiritual leadership. And so Titus' job is to teach the churches God's plan for that. Point doesn't mean that he selects the leaders, but to teach God's plan for what kind of men can serve so that the churches are equipped to follow God's will. And so, appoint elders in every city as I directed you. Now, as you start looking at these qualifications, this version says, if any man is. What kind of verb? Hey, here, grammar people. What kind of verb is the verb is? Boy, we've got a lot of response on that one. It's a to-be verb, right? What kind of words follow a to-be verb? What part of grammar? What kind? Action words? Either a predicate nominative or a predicate adjective. In other words, it's either the subject stated again in a different word or something that describes the subject. Okay? Some versions translate this must be, to-be verbs. The reason that's important is because what you have in these descriptions are character traits. Not what they're doing, but what they have done that says something about their character. It's a description of the man. The only reason you look at his wife, the only reason you look at his children, all of this stuff, is because of what it says about the man. That's the idea. A man is, or he must be. Now, the first thing is a husband of one wife. Well, I've got that one knocked out. He's only got one wife. He's been married to her for 40 years. Click him in, right? No. He can have one wife and not meet this qualification. Ever known of a man that's married to one wife but can't keep his eyes and hands off the ladies? He's not a one-woman man. And that's what Paul wrote. Man of one woman. That's what he wrote. Our translators, I have no squabble with it, have put husband of one wife, but there's no different word for husband or man or wife or woman in the Bible. He's a man of one woman. He's a one-woman man. What could impact a fellow having that character?
Adultery.
Huh? Adultery. What will help keep him from adultery? What?
Things that lead to adultery.
Things that lead to adultery, like what? What? Having a happy marriage. That's exactly right. We'll study a passage in Proverbs 5 later in our study, if the Lord is willing. It says exactly what was just said in the class. Yes. Same thing in 1 Corinthians 5 as well as Proverbs 5. And so one of the things that shuts the door to adultery is a happy, satisfying marriage relationship. So a woman says, I can't be an elder, so I'll just skip this section. No, ladies, you and your relationship with your man can impact whether churches have qualified leaders. Not only here, in years to come, but in churches throughout the land. Families can make a difference. There can be people who are so knowledgeable and so willing to serve, but because of sometimes things they can't even control, because the other mate is totally uncooperative, they are not qualified to serve as elders. You want to do something for the church, say, I can't preach, I can't serve as an elder, I can't whatever, but you can have a good, solid, satisfying family. There's another statement here. Young people in our class, do you see something in verse 5 that says something how you can decide whether or not certain men can serve? Verse 6, we'll try verse 6 then. What are you, young people, who do I want to call on here? Or y'all want to volunteer? Well, all of them got their head down now. Now, if you're reading the New King James Version, how does verse 6 read? Who's got the New King James Version? Okay, read it, please, Levi. Having faithful children. This verse says having children who believe. I prefer the New King James Version. Either translation is legitimate. It's okay. Because the word believe can be taken either active or passive here. And so many Christians think it's talking about having children who are Christians. I don't, personally. It's something about the man. Having faithful, so, well, faithful to God, that's Christian. No. Faithful to the man. How do I reach that conclusion? What's the contrast in the verse? Is it having faithful children, not pagans, not idolaters? What's the contrast?
Unruly.
Not unruly. Not accused of dissipation. That is, they're the kind of children that the dad can trust. They take the car, they leave. They go out with their friends. Dad and mom have to go to work. The kids are trustworthy. Why? because of the teaching, the influence, the example in their home. So here's a guy that can whip everybody with the Bible. He can lead a beautiful prayer. But what if he doesn't have children that he manages with dignity? That's the way 1 Timothy 3 talks about it. You young people, you can decide in days to come whether your daddy or somebody else's can serve in this capacity. That's how important the family is. Look at Mark 6. Mark 6, 17 through 19. Why would anybody want to have the preacher's head cut off? What?
Shut him up.
Shut him up. It's a good answer. Why do they want to shut him up? Don't like what he's preaching. That's the case here. Herod, verse 17, had sent and had John arrested and bound in prison on account of Herodias, the wife of his brother Philip, because he had married her. For John had been saying to Herod, "It is not lawful for you to have your brother's wife." Herodias had a grudge against him and wanted to put him to death and could not do so. And you know the rest of the story here. The daughter danced, and Herod said, "I'll give you up to half the kingdom," and so consulted with Mama and said, "Get his head." So they beheaded John the Baptist. What if there was a family in the congregation who was saying an adulterous marriage, and the preacher kept preaching on adultery? You can't put away your wife except for the cause of fornication. If you marry again, it's adultery. But this family's happy and they got kids. How could that impact the church, the fact that you got this family there? Could be divided. What did this woman, what did the text say? How did she feel about John? Had a grudge against him. Shut that guy up. I'm tired of hearing that kind of stuff. And so families can impact the kind of teaching a local church may do. If the preacher succumbs to that, says, "Man, I got to have a job," and any preacher that thinks that way ought to go do something else anyway. If he's preaching to have a job. But nevertheless, there are men who are impacted by threats and intimidations. They might get the guy fired. I've known that happening. Good friends of mine. A woman in a congregation getting a guy fired. And so the family, its order or disorder, can impact the local church. And that's very clear from Mark 6. Now, John wasn't preaching in a local church. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that here's a clear-cut case where a family disorder impacted the attitude of someone toward the preacher. And that can certainly happen in a local church. It doesn't have to be adultery. It could be something else. Look at Titus chapter 2. You notice I've got verse 4, 5, and 8. Verse 4, based on the first two words in it, talking about what kind of women? Older women. Look at verse 3. And then the rest of that verse talks about what kind of women? Younger women. Verse 6 talks about what kind of people? Young men. Now, when you read about all these different kinds of people in the churches on the island of Crete. Now, back up to chapter 1, verse 12. What kind of reputation did the people on the island of Crete have?
Liars.
Yeah, great reputation, huh? Remember, these are the folks you go to school with. These are the folks who live right next door, maybe down the block. You hear the way they talk. You see how they talk to mom and dad. You see how they disobey, how they sneak around, do things that are not right, how they dress, whatever it may be. You see young married women who cheat on their husbands, maybe. Older married women who don't know even how to find the book of Acts, much less teach anybody anything. And so forth. But look what he says, if you look in the text. He said, what reason, verse 5, does he give at the end of verse 5 for encouraging these older women to train these younger women to be that way? That's right. So that the word of God will not be dishonored. People look at your family, oh, that's Christians? Really? And that's the way quote-unquote Christian family operates? The bitterness, the shouting, the enmity, the disobedience, the cheating, the secrecy. Really? Look at the end of verse 8. You have it again. So that the opponent will be put to shame, having nothing bad to say about us. Young men. We got some young men here. We got Noah. We got Bailey. Who else? We got John Michael out there. Think about this as you get older, young fellas, that you can impact, your family can impact the reputation God's people have. Look down at verse 10, so that they will adorn the doctrine of God our Savior in every respect. There he's talking about bond slaves. All through here he's emphasizing that our conduct in the family, as a slave, wherever it may be, we ought to be lights in the world. And so the family can impact the reputation in the community God's people has. Okay, look at 1 Peter chapter 3. For sake of time, as I told you, we're not going to be able to get to everything. 1 Peter chapter 3. Here's a woman. We'll talk about this verse in more detail at a later lesson. What kind of marriage does she have, verse 1?
Her husband is an unbeliever.
Husband's an unbeliever. He's not obedient to the word. So, she's told to respect him, to be chaste. Why? He don't appreciate it. He still mistreats me. I don't like him. Why? According to the end of verse 4. No, the end of verse 4. That's a good answer, Ennis. That's verse 1. Why according to the end of verse 4? Here it is. Whether you win him over or not. Do you want to please God? That's the issue right there. What's precious in the sight of God. What kind of women do this? Look at the next verse. Women who hope in God. And so, you can see here that if a woman comes to class, let's say she comes, teaches the Bible classes. Maybe she teaches ladies' class. Maybe she knows all the parts to the song. Maybe she's active in helping people when there's a need. But what if she's not this kind of woman in the family? Does it impact her, how God looks at her? Evidently. God's not blinded by closed doors and shut blinds. Verse 7. He turns his attention to the men. And he said that men are to treat their wives with honor, with respect. Why? What reason does he give? Not my reason. What reason does he give? These people, remember, these are pagans who have become Christians. You can imagine the lifestyle they were used to. They've become Christian. Did they learn from their daddy how to treat a woman? Probably not. From their grandpa? Probably not. But they're to treat their wives with respect. Why? According to verse 7. Prayer not be hindered. That's okay. Can't pray, but I can wait on the table and I can observe the Lord's Supper, right? No. Prayer by synecdoche. What does that word mean? Part for the whole. Your worship will be impacted. Don't come out here and pray a pretty prayer, put money in the tray, and go home and not respect your wife. God won't have any of that, fellas. I wish I could say it wasn't so, but I know that happens. That's why the family, studying the family is so important. Don't you want to worship God? Don't you want God to look upon you with favor? It's not just whether we put a piano in the building. Not that. It's not just where we send our money. It's how you talk to your mate, how you think about your mate, how you treat your mate. That will impact your relationship with God. Turn to Galatians 5.
See,
yes, sir.
One point, like husband and wife there, the actions of the husband do not depend on what the wife does in sin.
Excellent point. Both sides of that.
Yes.
Good point, Doug made. We'll look more at that when we say that text. What the wife does is not dependent on the husband, not contingent on him being a good guy. Vice versa, he says, you just don't know what my wife is like. It made a difference. That's a good point Doug made. Not contingent on the other party. We always want to work on the other one instead of working on self. Look at Galatians 5. There are several categories of sins here. In verse 19 through 21, and according to the end of verse 21, what does he emphatically want these Galatian Christians to understand about these things? Put it in your own words. Not going to heaven. If you're not going to heaven, where are you going? I think you know the answer to that. Well, look at these categories of sins. Certainly you have one we've already talked about, deeds of immorality. You got immorality, impurity, sensuality. Not only the act of fornication, but those things associated with it. But then look at verse 20. You got two things that had to do with idolatry and sorcery. But then you've got four things that have to do with animosity, enmities, strife, jealousies, outbursts of anger. But I'd never commit adultery. Good for you. I'd never bow to an idol. Good for you. Do you control your temper? Oh, well, that's different. I can't help that. Really? You scream at your mate, your husband, your wife. You lose your temper. There's bitterness, strife. What did he say about that? That's okay as long as you go to the right church. He says you're not going to heaven. You live that way. That's how important the family is. Young people and parents, sometimes they get at one another's throat. Young people, you may not be a Christian yet. You will be one day, hopefully. You want to go to heaven? Family will impact that. Malachi 2:16. Some of you remember that verse. There's a statement there that should never be forgotten. What did God say? Do you remember that verse? I hate divorce. What? It may be difficult. It may sometimes you don't know what to do. But I'll tell you what, if when people get married, young people, when you get married, you take those vows. Don't be thinking about how pretty the building is and where you're going on your honeymoon and all that baloney. You think about those vows. Look at that passage. Malachi chapter 2. And this is said to religious people, the priests. He said, verse 14, how did they treat their wives? Verse 14, what word does he use? Treacherously. What does treacherous mean? What is a treacherous person? Sir?
Mean is all you have.
Okay. Huh? Unfaithful. You can't depend on it. You can't depend on their word. They violate their promises and their covenants. Look at the verse. You've dealt treacherously against who? The wife what? What did he say? By covenant. Your wife, look, he said, the wife of your youth, he said, verse 14, your companion, your wife by covenant. When people get married, do they enter into a covenant? When? That's right, when they say, I do. So the preacher gets up there, or whoever's doing it, and I'd be a preacher, maybe somebody else. You take this woman, you take this man, for better, or what's that other part? Worse. What does that mean? As long as I like him? What if you get to where you don't like him? What if he becomes fat and lazy? What if she becomes ugly as homemade soap? What if they're mean? What if they're inconsiderate? For better or for worse? Now, if you committed to that, you made that covenant, and more important to that mate is your relationship to God, you know what you're going to do? You're going to figure a way to make this work. And that's why people stay married. My mother and dad were married 66 years. My wife's mother and dad were married 56 years. And many people I could point out, I don't know, how long y'all been married? Well, this your second wife. Your first wife died. 44 years. Y'all never had an argument, right?
65 years for me total.
Okay. Y'all never had an argument, though, right? She said, don't answer. I don't know what she said. I'll put words in her mouth. But anyway. People do, and they get differences. But there's no option. There's no out option. The only out option, there's only two. What are they? One is death. What's the other one? Divorce you make for fornication. That's it. That's it. Of course, in a case of an unlawful marriage to begin with, people get marriages they didn't belong in. They ought to divorce then, get rid of that relationship because they're in sin. That's what you had in the book of Ezra. Okay. So it's a powerful verse there, verse 16. Young people, if you don't know where that verse is, write it somewhere in your Bible. Just remember that verse when you get married. You say, boy, things are I never thought things would be this bad. Go back and read this verse. Who said that? God did. I hate divorce. I hate it. Okay, so question four is just a thought and discussion question. While we're talking about thought and discussion, I need some guys here to help me. Jeff, would you help me? Here, John Michael, will you help me pass some of these out? I know you work, man. I saw this guy work at the Hinterfuss house. And here, pass the rest of these out, will you? This is a checklist. We'll have, with each lesson, we'll have a different checklist. We'll not be doing these in class. We just don't have time. I don't know how many people ever do these. I make these up. Let me tell you why I do this. Everything we've studied today will have zero value if we do not do what? Apply it. Don't apply it. And these are designed to help us get down to the practical, everyday, nuts and bolts applications of what we're talking about. That's what this is for. And what I encourage people to do is take this home, husbands and wives, and now we've got young people in our class. Sit down and talk about it together as a family. Say, what am I going to do for my family Bible study this week? Here's one thing you can do. Won't take you that long. Maybe you'll actually enjoy it, and it'll certainly be beneficial. So I encourage you to just go through here and look at some of these questions and sit down as a family. Turn that TV off. Put those iPads and phones down. Silence them if you have to. And spend some time just talking about some of these things. And if you have some good comments or suggestions or things that I could add to this list, I'm open. Just email them to me, okay? And I'll be glad to take a look at them, and I'd appreciate that. Okay, well, we'll stop there, and we didn't get to the figures there, but you can see on number four right at the bottom, in 2014, if you average it, every single day of the year, over 2,000 divorces. Imagine that. 2,000 a day. I don't know what it is this year or last year. Okay, we'll pick up with question number five in our next class.